Dr. Andy Galpin, you've shared something mind-blowing, which is you could take any test in the world you want. Full body MRI, blood pressure, smoking history, cholesterol, familial background for any kind of disease. You could put all those tests on a roulette table. You call this health roulette and spin it around, and almost nothing in the world predicts how long somebody's going to live compared to your VO2 max number. On today's podcast, you're breaking down all things VO2 max, including what it is, how to get it measured, what to do if it's low, which it's going to be low for a lot of people listening potentially, and most importantly, why it's so important to get the number up, not just to feel better, but to potentially add decades. Yes, decades to your life if you get it into the optimal ranges. So I'm going to turn it over to you to talk about VO2 max.
You go back to the late 1980s, 1989, I think actually Stephen Blair, who was this legendary exercise epidemiologist, if you want to call him that, from University of South Carolina. He's done a ton of research. Actually, I think the paper you're talking about specifically came out in JAMA, the Journal of American Medical Association, one of these top tier ones. And that's kind of like this classic paper that we refer to. But again, it's not one study. I'm not cherry picking and trying to overestimate the importance here. Like you literally have 30 plus years of studies that are saying the same thing. Now, in exact detail, no. Of course, like every study's, the numbers are a little bit different and the populations. But if you collectively look at that research, you can kind of fast forward all the way also up to Jonathan Meyer's work at Stanford. And that actually paper with 700,000 people or so was U.S. veterans because Jonathan works at his Stanford VA appointment up there. And so you're talking about, you know, you pick your study. Blair's study had about the same numbers. Jonathan's paper from like early 2000s showed the same thing. You know, you're talking about database pools of hundreds of thousands of people. And what they do in this is they look at and they calculate what's called hazard ratios. Right? So what that is, it's a little bit complicated. The effect of this is if you set everybody in the group, let's just say we had 100,000 people in a study. And these typically, sometimes they isolate. So they want to look at 100,000, 40 to 60 year olds. Okay, great. Sometimes it's like, hey, 18 to 95 year olds. Right. And so again, I'm kind of combining a number of different papers in this explanation here to make it a little bit simpler to digest. So if you look across all those papers, it's the same general point here that I'm making. The exact numbers don't matter per se, because they are tweaked and varied. But effectively, you put all these people in these databases, and then what you look at is, well, how many people died? And so a lot of times you either look retrospectively. So you look back through hospital records and stuff like that. Or in the case of some of these studies, you literally track these people for 20 plus years, right? And so when you look at that, in Jonathan's paper, I think there was 750,000-ish people in that study and 174,000 died over the course of the study. Now, again, it's like they're not giving them a drug and the drug killed them or anything. It's just sort of like, hey, you're enrolled in the study, you do this test, and then we just monitor your medical records. And then when you die, we get an alert and we put it in. And then, you know, after 20 years, we look back and say, what are the things consistent with the people that died versus those that didn't die? And so they look at typically lots of stuff. And those metrics you mentioned a second ago, smoking, history of coronary artery disease, familial concerns, diabetes, like all these things. And it's clear that stuff's all bad. All that stuff increases your HR ratio, right? And so typically the study will look at something like if your HR goes from at 1.0 is baseline, right? So that's everyone is set to a standard of 1.0. If you're below one, you've reduced risk. Above one, you've increased risk. So in the studies you're pulling from the data there, you're thinking like you're looking at like diabetes and cholesterol, blood pressure, hypertension, stuff like that. The HR on those is typically like 1.3, 1.4, 1.2, which represents 1.2 would be a 20% increase. 1.3 would be a 30% increase. 1.8 would be an 80% increase. Okay, that's how you interpret those numbers. And what that is an increased risk, right? Doesn't mean you're going to die, but it's just an increased risk. Well, when you compare that to the numbers on VO2 max, when you look at the group who is the most fit in this database and you compare them to the least fit, the ones that are the least fit, their HR is not 1.4. It's like 4.5, 5.0, 6.1s. Like it is enormous. And so if you want to look at like the risk of diabetes, it's typically like, hey, 1.3, 1.4, smoking 1.4, great. being super unfit, 5.0. Like it's just way, way, way higher on this. In fact, you can get even more granular. So typically what these studies will do is they'll break people in the entire study up into either quintiles or quartiles or something like that, which is just says, take everybody in the study, whether 25, the highest 25% most fit, then who are the next 25%, who are the next 25%, then who's the bottom 25%, right? And the bottom versus the top is what I just explained. But even if you look at like the second highest level to the next, to the absolute highest level, you're still seeing like doubling of your risk factor. And so as an order of effect, it's just not even close how much more VO2 max will explain survival. Now, there is multiple factors here going on. So obviously people who live longer tend to be fitter, but then there's clearly a causal explanation here between having a higher VO2 max in this case and having an increased risk of survival. None of those other things that I mentioned are good for you. Diabetes is a really big problem and all the other stuff, but that's the stuff you're referring to. So when I say like you can put it all on the table and you should definitely pay attention to your diabetes and smoking and all that stuff, and you should pay attention to your cholesterol if it matters and to you and blood pressure, like absolutely, that stuff will, can absolutely kill you and take decades off your life. But if you really want to get an honest answer of how close to, you know, you're at on that death door, your VO2 max is going to be very, very, very insightful. And you could argue, you know, as I said earlier, that it's probably the number one thing to look for.
Today's episode is brought to you by the Birch Mattress by Helix. So we all know that getting a good night's sleep is super important, not just for our health in general, but for being a functional and thriving human being. I can tell you that when my sleep suffers, the next day is rough. That's why I'm so psyched about today's sponsor, Birch Mattress by Helix. I've been sleeping on my Birch mattress for 3 years now. True story, and it's the real deal. The Birch mattress is certified eco-friendly, organic, and fair trade. Plus, they're made from natural, non-toxic materials. That's important for a couple reasons. First, with Birch, I'm avoiding a ton of VOCs and off-gassing chemicals that most other mattresses emit and that mess with the quality of my sleep, and probably yours too. Secondly, I can sleep better at night knowing that I'm supporting a company that does right by their employees and the environment. You just can't find that at a typical mattress store. I absolutely love my Birch mattress, and right now you can get your own for 20% off plus two free Eco Rest pillows at birchliving.com/Drew. So get ready for the best, most eco-friendly sleep of your life. Visit Birch, B-I-R-C-H, living, LIVING.com/Drew. That's DHRU to get 20% off plus two Eco Rest pillows today. This episode is brought to you by LifeForce, the diagnostic company I personally use every quarter. You know, I love learning about the latest longevity research, but ever since I turned 40, I'm even more interested in learning how to apply it to my life so that I can get the most benefit. That's why I was super excited when I found out about LifeForce, a revolutionary new health platform that's changing the game when it comes to personalized performance and longevity-based action plans. Here's what sets LifeForce apart from all other testing companies out there. For one, LifeForce's diagnostics measure over 40 different biomarkers, including fasting insulin, ApoB, and many other organ health markers, giving you a big picture of your chronic disease risk and cardiometabolic health. Number two, LifeForce makes working with a functional medicine practitioner easy. Their team connects you with top-notch doctors that put all the pieces together, and those doctors recommend a whole plan that includes supplements and lifestyle changes for your unique biological needs. Not every other diagnostic company out there can say that. And lastly, number three, LifeForce makes tracking your progress more convenient than ever. They send a licensed phlebotomist to your door every 3 months, and they'll adjust your plan based on how your body and your biomarkers change. If you're serious about optimizing your longevity, you have to check out LifeForce. Right now, you can save $250 off your first diagnostic by visiting mylifeforce.com/DHRU. That's mylifeforce.com/DHRU to save $250 off your first diagnostic and optimize your health and longevity today. So for a lot of my audience who's listening, they've definitely heard the term VO2 max. I've gone on my own journey to improve my own VO2 max, getting it measured in a laboratory. But for the person that's listening today, and they're not a professional athlete. You know, they're somebody that wants to work out, they want to eat healthy, and they want to age well. Could you give them a reminder of what VO2 max is? And then is it important for them to get a baseline? And if so, how would you recommend going about getting a baseline?
Yeah, absolutely important to get a baseline. How do you get it? And then I'll come back to the previous one. You can do like what you've done, and you can look out and just kind of Google search in your area. Is there a laboratory that offers the VO2 max test? There are more and more of these, and they are continuing to increase. In fact, you're seeing a lot of just commercial gyms put these things into place, and you're going to see more of that because the word on this information has gotten out, and it's, I don't know why it took 30 years. it did. I actually foresee a future where it's going to be really, really common as it is to get almost a blood draw because of how important this stuff is. So you can do that. Typical cost there, depending on the area you live, is somewhere between $75 to maybe $250 if you live in Manhattan or Chicago or Dallas or downtown or something. But a couple of $100, which is more than some people can afford. I get it. But a lot of people, I think, can scratch out $150. Yeah, so you could have that conversation, but hopefully we could, you know, again, many can't at all. I understand that. But if you can't at all, there are a number of scientifically validated, both submaximal as well as maximal estimate tests. So what do I mean by that? You can do something like a Cooper's 12-minute test. This is a maximal test. You're going to basically run for 12 minutes as far as you possibly can, record that distance. Take that distance, and then you can plug it into calculators. There's tons of them online. Just Google that test and enter that score you got, and it'll tell you an estimate of your VO2 max. And again, that has been scientifically validated. It's been around for decades. It's not new at all. It's been around for a very, very long time in the exercise physiology community. So you can do that. That's totally free. If you're like, man, I can't run, I've got a knee injury, or I'm just really nervous or apprehensive about going that hard, I've never done that, or any number of reasons, then you can do a submaximum test. And so again, many, many, many variations of these. There are bike tests you can do. There are rowing tests. There are swimming tests. There are walking tests. So there are VO2 max estimate equations for whatever you're thinking of, like, oh, I can't do it because of this. Snow on the ground. I can't go run outside. Okay, great. Like, there's tons of ways you can do it and estimate equations. And all of them are free online. Like, you can go in there because they've been around for 25 years. So that they're no longer behind like even paywalls and journals. They're out there because they've been around for so long. The submax tests are typically 2 minutes or so. And what this typically looks like is something where you take your resting heart rate, and then you step up onto a box. And these boxes are typically like 18 inches tall. So not like a big CrossFit, you know, box jump thing. Like, you're just stepping up and down. And you do it to a metronome. So, you know, you have a rhythm, step, 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 step. And so the reason we're doing that is so we can kind of lock in effort, if you will. But even that part's not critical. And you do it for 2 minutes, and then you check your heart rate at the end of the 2 minutes. That score, then, that resting heart rate, you enter that end of exercise heart rate, enter that in, and it will estimate your VO2 max. Now, as you leave the laboratory and you go into the field, the accuracy of the test starts to come down, right? And then as you go from maximal to submaximal, it comes down. So if you want perfect, you want to know exactly what this number is, you know, find a lab and go get it done. But those other ones are going to get a lot of people close, and they hopefully meet everyone who's listening where they're at on some level, right? So depending on what exercise you want to do, depending on your income, depending on what's available to you or where, you should be able to get pretty close to those numbers. So in terms of practical application, those are your first two answers here a little bit. Now, going all the way back to the first part of your question, it is technically VO2 stands for, the V is volume of oxygen. It is how much air or oxygen you can bring in and utilize. And it has two major components. One is what we call central, one is peripheral. And what I mean by that is it is VO2 max is calculated as your cardiac output, which is we call Q, multiplied by your AVO2 difference. And so cardiac output is specifically how much blood can be pumped out of your heart per pump. That's called your stroke volume, multiplied by how many beats your heart beats per minute, your heart rate, right? So what's the heart rate? How often is it pumping? Multiplied by how much blood is pumping out per pump. And that tells you your cardiac output, okay? And again, that's the output of blood. Think of it that way. That's the central version. Now, the peripheral version is then when that blood is pumping through your body, ideally, your muscles that are exercising are able to get that blood into them. And then specifically, they can take the oxygen out of the blood and get it into the muscle tissue. And they can take the waste products like carbon dioxide and other things like that and take them from muscle and put it into blood. So that when your blood comes into muscle, it's oxygenated. And when it comes in full of glucose and things like that, and then when it leaves muscle, it is deoxygenated and full of waste products and carbon dioxide. That then goes back to your heart, goes back to your lungs. You breathe out the CO2. You take another breath in, that O2 comes back in, and we repeat that cycle, right? So you're breathing in oxygen, you're breathing out CO2, and you're cycling there. So the second half of our equation, remember we had our cardiac output, our Q, multiplied by what's called AVO2 difference. So AVO2 difference is the difference in the amount of oxygen in the arterial side minus the venous side. That's a fancy way of saying how much oxygen went into your tissue and then how much was in the blood after it left your tissue. That's the arterial side versus the venous side. And so the better you are at extracting oxygen into your tissue, the higher that number becomes. And since it's a multiplier, a high AVO2 multiplied by a cardiac output, both those numbers go up, then the VO2 max goes up. And so that was technically what that functionally means, and I can translate that all. How well can you bring in oxygen? How much of that blood can you pump through your system? And how effective are you at getting the oxygen out of your blood into your working muscle? That tells us exactly the volume of oxygen you can utilize. And we typically express that number in units of milliliters. That's milliliters of oxygen, so you know, measurement per kilogram of body weight per minute. So when you see like a kind of heuristic we use a lot is 50 at 50, which means you should, you know, strive for a VO2 max of 50 milliliters, so 50 milliliters of oxygen per kilogram of body weight per minute, right? That's VO2 max of 50 at age 50. So that's kind of a number we want to get to. It's pretty high, but that would be for men. For women, it's probably 45 at 50 would be great. So VO2 max 45 at 50 would be a solid number to go after. And that scales with age and stuff like that. But that's really what VO2 max honestly truly is.
And it can sound a little technical, and I appreciate the technical explanation, but just to make sure people really understand, and this point drives home, is that any activity that you're going to be doing as you age, especially as you get into your 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond, hopefully, knock on wood, that we all make it there, you know, our capacity to take in oxygen, turn it into energy, is a key factor into that. What are some examples of some things? Let's take for your, you know, your average 70-year-old, which is not even really that old, right? Like, things and activities that you can share that commonly are things that people struggle with that is a good indication that, hey, actually their VO2 max is not good, and that's why they can't do this normal everyday activity. Can you think of any?
Yeah, I mean, I can think of a ton. The way to think about it is this. You use carbohydrates and fat for the most part for your cellular energy. Oxygen is not used for energy. Oxygen is simply used because it is required to be there to aerobically use fat and carbohydrates as a fuel. Why that matters is the following. If you are doing a function in which your VO2 max is so low that you can no longer produce energy at that rate, then you can no longer continue the activity, right? And so you don't have enough oxygen to allow your body to actually metabolize carbohydrates and fat. That becomes an issue. And so that metabolic process then is leveled out. What's that functionally mean? Think about it this way. If your VO2 max for men, it's about 18 milliliters per kilogram per minute. For women, it's about 15 or 16. Those lines are called the line of independence. Below that line, it becomes challenging to live independently. That's why we call them that. So if you're a male listening and your VO2 max is 15, you're probably not living by yourself. Or if you are, your days of doing that are fairly limited. If you're a woman and you're at 13, it's the same answer. Okay, these numbers are just slightly lower because of a number of physiological reasons that don't matter per se right now. If you are not at that level and you're like, I live by myself, like I'm fine, Okay, what you can actually do is you can calculate how long is going to be at your current VO2 max before you cross that line of independence. There are known rates of decline is typically about 1% per year, especially after the age of 40, 45, or something like that. And so you can just run a little simple calculation that says, all right, if I'm at 30 right now, my VO2 max is 30, and I'm 40 years old, how long until I cross below 20? Well, it ain't going to be very long. So you might be fine now, but by the time you're 65, you're going to be below 20. And so your numbers you're worrying about now are to be like, well, what do I have to do to keep myself above that line for as long as possible? What does 20 milliliters per kilogram per minute look like? Well, getting dressed in the morning is, 12, something like that. Walking upstairs is 13, 14, depending. Something like that. So you're staring on the barrel of going, okay, great. A light jog, 15 to 20, something like you can't even jog for a couple of steps is what 20 means. So right now you're like, oh, I can jog. Okay, a little bit, but if you're at 30, how long until that number again crosses below 20? The reason we, again, when we're talking, we call that independence is you can think about it as functional independence because you can't even function independently because basic what are called activities of daily living, like getting dressed in the morning, like going upstairs, like walking around a carnival or a fair or something like that for a few hours is debilitating because it requires such a high percentage of your energy. Maybe I'll give you one more example. If your VO2 max is 25 as a woman, okay, great. And walking around, the baseball field, watching your nephew or grandkid or ch your own child play, and that takes you to 15. You can do it, but you're actually running at about 60, 65% of your VO2 max. That's like the rest of us, like jogging for 7 straight hours. That's going to be exhausting to you, right? You're going to be completely exhausted, which means you're going to want to do less stuff. You're going to be bringing the chair. You're going to have to take a break and sit down. Or you're not going to want to do it next time. You're not likely to enroll the kid or go to the next event. You're just like, oh my God, I got so tired last time. It completely crushes you. And so you just don't want to do things. And it's really physically exhausting, not because it's a higher than your VO2 max. And you're not sitting there thinking, like, I literally can't do it. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about everything just is so demanding. Where this often manifests itself is people are just going, man, my energy is so low. Why is your energy so low? You're running around every day at 65% of your VO2 max. You don't have thyroid dysfunction. Your testosterone's not low. You don't like have all these things that are going. I mean, that obviously can't happen. But a lot of the times it's like you're just unfit. You don't have something going on here. And if you do, sometimes it is because you are so unfit that you are overtraining effectively. You're overtraining so much because everything requires such a high percentage of your VO2 max, your system is shot.
Wow,
That is a
that's a concept that I've never heard. Sorry to just jump in. That's literally mind blowing. I never heard that concept shared in that way, that people are literally inactive so much that just their normal day-to-day function is overtraining because they're so unfit. I've never heard that, and that is like mind blowing. Like that makes total sense.
yeah, I would say we have a coaching program that we've been running for a long time. Of course, we've worked with and still work with a ton of professional athletes, but the coaching program I'm referring to is called Rapid Health and Performance, and it's almost exclusively for non-athletes. Most of our clients are 40 to 50, plus year olds or so. So like right in this realm, probably the biggest driver we've had of people coming in the program is my energy's down. My energy's down, right? It can be a number of different things. We test everything. It's a very comprehensive program, and sometimes it's sleep related. Sometimes it's all kinds of, micronutrient imbalances. There's all kinds of things that can be explaining it. But one of the large ones we see is it's like, okay, yeah, you're just unfit. And this is like your energy will come way back once you get a little more fit. And every time we improve somebody's VO2 max, like the number one most consistent feedback in addition to everything else is my energy's way up. Like, yeah, you didn't need testosterone. You didn't need hormone replacement therapy. When your VO2 max is at a certain number, it is simply an issue of why would you have a ton of energy if you have no oxygen availability? What makes you think you would have a ton of energy? Another, you know what the next one we get is probably it's brain fog, clarity, like focus, attention, memory. And when it's like I'm getting old, I'm like, you're 50. Like your brain's not deteriorating at 50. Like you're 60 for that matter. Your brain is not deteriorating at 60. Unless you have something else going on, which most people almost never do. It's the fact that you don't have energy. You don't have cellular energy because your O2 is really, really low. And when that starts to go up a little bit because you get excited in a meeting or you do a little bit of movement parts and you're up and like you get really exhausted because you're burning a lot of gas at a really high percentage of your VO2 max, where the rest of us are cruising at 20%, you're at 50%. And so, yeah, like you're going to feel low energy.
And to take it back to a point that you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, is that it becomes a downward spiral. You're low in
Oh,
energy.
definitely.
You continue to age. You start to feel totally exhausted doing normal activities. You pull back. Then that turns into sort of this rapid decline, especially towards the later stages of life, where, as you mentioned, you start to feel like you're a burden. You start to feel like people have to help you out of the car. You start to feel that you can't walk as fast or keep up with people. So you exclude yourself from social activity, participation, and now all of a sudden we're rapidly going downhill.
And we also see this is where stimulants will come in a lot. So your energy is low. And so you really get crushing on coffee. You really get crushing on tea and energy drinks or whatever they happen to be. Not that any of those things are bad per se, but when in this particular cycle, you get crushing on those things, or potentially you go to hormone therapy with very poor guidance, right? So you're not listening to your doctor, or your doctor is kind of half paying attention and just write you the script. And why those things become an issue is the stimulants in particular is because now you're crushing stimulants to get throughout the day. And then when you get to the evening, you can't fall asleep. Or you fall asleep, but you wake up in the middle of the night. Like, I always consistently wake up at one. Or you wake up, you toss and turn a bunch, and you're just really. And so the next day, what happens? You're even more fatigued. You're even like your energy is low because you are not sleeping well. And so then it is back to inactivity, it is back to stimulants. And we're on that cycle. And so, yeah, like it adds a whole bunch of stuff. And so we got to come back all the way to go, yo, we got to get you off the stimulants. But then I won't be productive. I still have a company to run. I still have kids to chase after. I still have all these things. Great. We're going to get your VO2 max up. And then we're going to do that. And so we're going to run this program of like, we're going to get you off of those synthetic energies and get you onto a natural energy, if you will, here. And then as a result, your sleep will improve. And then that'll make your natural energy better. And then that whole thing spins up, is what we call it. Like, your life spins down when you do things like that. We want to turn the whole thing around and start spinning things up. So life just gets easier. It gets even better though, because there's a lot of data on what happens with things like nutritional choices, with insufficient sleep, with low energy status. We know this will directly lead to worse and poorer nutritional choices. You're likely to have a little more alcohol than you normally would. Maybe you don't drink that much, but now you're drinking 50% more than you normally would. We know that food quality choices, total amount of choices, physical activity choices, all this stuff gets worse, right? And so you're eating a little bit more than you should. You're having just, if you, I mean, you eat pretty good, but like you have a couple of more treats, you get a little bit sloppier, 20% more, right? 10% more. That stuff gets magnified over time. And all of a sudden, you're a little bit overweight. You don't like how you look. And now you're thinking, like, oh my gosh, but I'm so tired all the time. How am I going to ever work out? And like you can see this, like it spins into multiple areas. And now you're just like, oh my gosh. That often leads to lens like, well, I'm just gonna live my life and like the logic and discussion kind of, or not. I'm still trying to get after it and you train hard, but you're just not getting anywhere because you're so tired and it's so exhausting. Okay, I get it. Like that's what happens in these spin down situations. So we want to make sure that we are correcting that train and that we are solving as much as possible. We call these performance anchors. So what was the real anchor here? Not necessarily what was the symptom. Like, what is the thing that's really, as best we can tell, driving? Or what are the two or three or four, whatever the case is, things that are driving this? And how do we correct those so that this entire ship starts to right itself? And then we're not just really going out and putting every single finger in every hole in the ship. Let's figure out why we keep having holes in the ship and fix that. And then, be a little patient, be a little consistent, and watch the results come, come in as the months go on. And then a year or two from now, like you can't believe how your life has changed, and maintenance is pretty low.
Guys, you've heard everyone talk about the benefits of cold therapy. In fact, some of the top experts in this space have been on my podcast. Well, you can add me to that list of people who love using cold therapy. And one of the main things that I love about it, my favorite reasons, are that it makes me feel more alert, more focused, and more energized. Plus, it's doing some other incredible things for my body, including promoting better sleep, providing support for pain relief, boosting my immune system, reducing stress, and the list goes on and on. I make it a habit to hop into the plunge at least a few times a week. It's a key part of my cold therapy and longevity protocol. Trust me, it's like hitting the refresh button on your body and your mind. I consider it one of my top secret weapons. And my favorite way to use cold therapy is with plunge. It's the best cold plunge on the market by far. It's so easy to use and it doesn't require any special wiring or plumbing, just some space and an electrical outlet. It's designed for indoor or outdoor use. It's a sleek design and it fits seamlessly into any space. If you're looking to incorporate cold therapy into your life, I highly recommend the Plunge. It's something I'm committed to using in my life and I think you're going to love it too. Right now, Plunge is offering my community $150 off. That's a lot. $150 off cold plunges and their core products. Just go to Plunge, plunge.com/DHRU. That's plunge.com/Drew or enter the code DHRU to get $150 off today. You know, to continue down this pathway of VO2 max, because it's so important, and that's not just your opinion, that's the summary of the data that's out there. You've been one of the people that's been championing it in a way that's really brought it to popularity. Question for you, which is that more and more individuals now have things like Apple Watches and smartwatches. A lot of those will have some sort of VO2 max sort of proxy measure inside of there. Can individuals that are listening today that might be intimidated to go to a lab particularly, or maybe like a hospital setting, can they use these watches, or is that data good data?
Yeah, it's a really hard question because the answer is a little bit of both. Some of the products seem to be okay, especially at moderate to low VO2 maxes, but they tend to get pretty wonky at moderate to high ones. So they tend to overestimate is one way to think about it. So if you're like, you don't really exercise, you kind of exercise a little bit and you go out and you do something and your Apple Watch tells you your VO2 max is 46, probably not. Like probably not, right? If you're 40 years old, 50 years old, 60 years old, and it's telling you that number, it's possible. Like we have seen it. We've had people actually in our program, like don't exercise. And it's like, we get a test and it's like 48. Like in the lab, and we're like, oh shit, okay. So it can happen, but it's unlikely. So what I would typically say is, you know, if you're getting numbers there, just be cautious that you're getting over interpreted there. But I don't want to take away the barrier to entry here. And so if that's the thing you got already, I wouldn't go out and buy one for that purpose. Is maybe that's the way to think about it. Don't go buy one for that purpose. But if you already have one, or you already use one, or you like it for other reasons, you like the accountability, you like the awareness, it's fun, it's making it more joyful. Those are tremendous reasons to use a wearable, and I do not want to take you away from that. Great. If you're tracking your VO2 max on it and you see it's going up and it's a motivator, then that's a win. I don't care if that number is telling you your VO2 max is 6 or 6,000. Doesn't matter. You're getting better. That's all we're at. That's, you know, key thing number one, don't kill motivation with information. Okay. If you're going in the right direction and you're motivated to do it, let's not worry about nitpicking, you know, 20% accuracies or something like that. That said, typically I will defer to companies whose primary and sole goal are fitness. You think of, I don't have any relationship to them, but think of Garmin. Like Garmin is polar. Like these are companies who have made heart rate monitors as their primary product for 50 years. This is what they do. They're better. Apple sort of throws some stuff on there. Other companies, like, but they're cell phone companies. They're other stuff. Like, this is a thing that they can do, and they can do it okay. But I tend to defer to things like, again, like the Garmin and the Polar Strap, where it's like, this is literally the core of your company. This is your core competency. This is what you do. And those products, not surprisingly, are more scientifically accurate. So also at the same time, you don't need to go spend $400 on a Polar if you don't want, if you don't care, like if you already have it. So hopefully that kind of helps everyone. Because I hate just having people go buy hundreds of dollars worth of stuff. But I also don't want to tell you like, hey, all the progress and the good work you're doing, it sucks. Don't do it. I don't want that message either.
Yeah. for those individuals that do live nearby a gym, I'm based here in Los Angeles. There's a gym in Santa Monica that I went to, no affiliation with them. They're called TriFit. I went and did my VO2 max in person with the whole setup and the machine and the mask. If somebody wants to go do that, from my understanding that there's a couple ways of doing that. You could do that. Running is probably one of the most common ways. Mm-hmm. The next one would be rowing and then also a bike. One thing in particular that I struggle with is that I don't run a lot. And so I didn't even run in proper running shoes. And so I scored a 47, but I ended up having to stop early because my knees were hurting, probably because I was wearing the wrong shoes. And I didn't even know that we were going to do running. So is there any guidance you want to share for individuals here who are like, okay, you know what? I want to go into a gym. I want to get a benchmark so that I can know then what activities I can do to improve it, which we'll get to in a second. Do you have any preference of any of those activities, running, rowing, biking, or anything else that might be there?
Running is by far the most common. The overwhelming majority of our scientific studies and databases are on running. But second is biking. Tons and tons and tons and tons of research on biking. Rowing is newer, way, way, way less data, but that's fine. You know, do whatever you want to do there. In terms of the way VO2 max works, remember, it's how much oxygen you can bring in and utilize. That is determined by how much tissue and how much muscle you're using. And so the more muscle mass involved in your testing, the higher your score will be. You will see a higher score on about 10% higher on running than you will on biking because there's more muscles involved. You do other activities, scales up. This is why you typically see on average, cross-country skiers are the highest folks in terms of VO2 max because they're using their legs as well as their upper body. So if you do it on a bike, it's fine, but you can take whatever score you have and you can add 10%, and that's probably your what we call more of your true VO2 max, okay? That said, specificity matters, and there's lots and lots of research on this. If you are a cyclist and you cycle, you will probably score higher on a cycling test than you will a running test. Okay, so that whole 10% higher on running, like I said a second ago, goes out the window. Yeah, same thing with the rowing. If you are a rower, and we actually have a couple of rowers that are getting ready for Paris in the Olympics, you're gonna score way higher on a row than you will on a run. We will sometimes use even like an assault bike. So this is a bike with like the pedals and the handles. I know this is my friend Roman, who's runs the like kind of exercise science department at the UFC Performance Institute in Vegas. He has an entire protocol for the assault bike, and that's how they do all their VO2 max testing. Because in MMA, number one, many of those fighters don't run. And so they get on the treadmill and it looks really, really bad. but more importantly, it's a lot closer to their sport using their arms and their legs, and there's more muscle mass involved and all that. So any of them are options. If you have a preference towards one, that's great. If you have a hatred towards one, avoiding it is no problem whatsoever. You should be able to do it. Last context I'll give you here is if you have a known issue with one, you have an injury, you know you aren't good at running, things like that, then I would choose, you know, don't pick the one that you're going to have, you know, problems with. So if you were to go in and say, hey, look, man, I'm not a runner. I'm not good at running. My technique is up. My knee hurts when I do it. Okay, just don't do it because none of those tests matter unless you get the full maximum output. That's what we're trying to test. So if you have to stop at 80% or 90%, or you feel apprehensive, or you start getting nervous because your back hurts when you run too much, or whatever the case is, then don't do it because whatever percent loss we're going to get in effectiveness there, we're going to lose out on effort. And that's not really what we're after. So just don't pick things that you're worried about or don't want to do or otherwise think is gives you nerves and pick a different route.
That's great. You know, when you go online, there's all these incredible charts that are out there. I'll just pull up one that's there. You know, there's these VO2 max charts. This in particular is for women and it has the, you know, the highest. Okay.
So sorry, just to give you a little bit of thing there. You see the bottom, those comparative references? You see where it says Kaminsky and Harbor?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So those are my friends, Lenny Kaminsky and Matt Harbor. Those are data from the cardiac rehab laboratory that I did my PhD in.
Oh, incredible.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
So those guys were there and I was there during collection of all those data and all that. So.
Oh, that's amazing. That's awesome.
Yeah. Nice random choice there.
Yeah. What's that? The Kevin Bacon game that people used to play with movies. We can do that with
scientists.
Yeah, we can do that with Dr. Andy.
Yeah, and just another thing, actually, just so the audience, I know some of you are probably not watching this, but just a little bit of context. The other source down there, that Madsanger one, that 2018 paper, that's the very, very common standard one that people pull up for our current databases. So I say that to say, you can pull up random charts and equations on the internet, and you're always like, yeah, man, is this one real or not? If this one is truly based on those data points, this is the scientific gold standard right now. So correct choice to go off. So whatever numbers we get into right now, they're going to be pretty legit.
Fantastic. So connecting this to the chart here, and for those that are watching on YouTube, you can see the chart. We'll link it in the show notes. If you're listening on podcast, you can come back to it. So your statement earlier was you could pick any test in the world you want, full body MRI, yeah, blood pressure, smoking history, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Almost nothing in the world will predict how long you're going to live, you know, compared to your VO2 max. So let's say a woman in her 40s today, listening to my podcast here and listening to you talk, decides to go in and get her benchmark done. And they come in, you know, not too different than the clients that work with you. And they, looking at this chart here, what would be an average score that you would expect from somebody who's not, you know, a trainer, not an elite athlete, not regularly doing that, but just somebody who's just doing normal activities in their 40? Where would you expect them to be scoring based on this chart?
So you're asking me what would be the most common number?
Most common, yes.
Yeah. So a 40-year-old woman, probably in the mid-30s, go to max 35, 30, something like, yeah, right there.
Yeah, okay. So we're highlighting in the category that says good, which is the 64% lower section.
We definitely would not call that good. But that's what the chart says.
The chart says good. And this is why I wanted to bring it up, is that good or normal isn't optimal. And your work and your team's work and the coaching you do and everything you talk about is, how do we get to optimal? If we look around and everybody is overweight, obese in the society, just because that's normal doesn't mean that's what's actually healthy. So let's say they come in and they score in that sort of, mid-30s
was the range? Yep.
Where would you want them to be, knowing that they're heading in the right direction and that they're aging, you know, in a place that's not going to leave them in a troubling situation as they get into their 50s, 60s, 70s, and beyond?
Yeah, sure. So if you look at that chart, if you're able to watch this right now, and if not, I'll try to do it verbally. If you are in the mid-30s as a 40-year-old, you're pretty average, which would be great. And in all of our women that have come in our program that look like that, in terms of age range, seeing someone between 25 and 30 is very, very common. We have had countless women that are under 25. And these are women, again, in your 40s. You don't have a disease. You're not severely obese. Maybe you're probably working out a couple times a week. You don't feel like terrible or crazy. Maybe you don't feel great, all those stuff. And we have had plenty of these women who are under 25. And we're like, yo. And I have to walk them through the data and be like, this is what you're staring down the barrel of. And they're just like, holy hell. I wanted to say that because even that bottom 25 percentile, that's not some random rare fluke things that, like, you have to be really, really, it'd be obvious, right? You're super unhealthy. That's not the case. It is very, very common to see people at that level. We've had plenty that are like 21, 22. And you're like, woof.
And you'd look at them from the outside and you wouldn't necessarily know that they're an unhealthy or unfit person, right?
Bingo. Yes, exactly right. Thank you. That's on a point I was trying to make. Like, you don't necessarily know these things. When you look at something like body fat and body composition, this is obviously very associated with health, like very clearly. It's also something that as you're kind of alluding to, like, you'll see it, right? Like, okay, I'm not healthy. But that this case a lot will tell you, like, you're not healthy either. In fact, if you want to look at the data, if you look at the risk of death because of being overweight, whether you go from overweight to obese or extremely morbidly obese, what they call it, and you stack that against fitness will outpredict by 2x obesity.
Wow.
Right? Like, this is what I'm saying. And so we'll say a lot of times to folks, like, while you're working on the overweight thing or whatever, that's cool, that's great, like, super important, all that. But this is more important, actually. Like, just be fit. Let's get fit. Let's make sure we're fit first. This is our first step. We will say a lot of times, people come in and they'll say things like, "Hey, I need to lose weight to get healthier." Like, okay, again, great. That's a true statement. But we'll say we got to get healthy first. Right? We got to get healthy first to help weight loss. Like that, typically our first step. And so, yeah, we want to go after that. Want to make sure I laid that foundation. Very, very common. Where we want people to actually be. I mentioned earlier, right? 50 of 50 for men, 45 at 50 for women. So what's that mean for 40-year-old women? On this chart, you can see the superior group, which means the top 2 percentile is above 45. I still want to see that. I think Peter Attia has said this very well. You want to be in the elite category for the decade before. Now, elite in this chart is like way off. So think of this as like superior. Okay, in this phraseology, it'd be superior. What's that mean? So for somebody 48 years old, 49 years old, I want that VO2 max ideally to match their age. 48, 49. Let's see it above 50. Like that's my gold standard. If you look at any of those papers I'm talking about earlier, not only is there all that benefit, but one of the things you'll see consistently is that there appears to be no upper limit to benefit, such that you continue to increase your VO2 max, you continue to reduce your risk of all-cause mortality, and your survival chances continue to rise. Now, this differs for some other metrics where if you were to imagine someone like their squat strength, it's like, hey, if you're let's use leg press. It's a little bit easier. Let's say you're 180 pounds and you can leg press 100 pounds. I can tell you right now, getting stronger will enhance your life quality and life length. Okay. If you are 180 pounds and you increase your leg press from 200 to 250, you'll still see an increase in both those metrics, right? It still matters. If you're 180 pounds and you can leg press 600 pounds and I increase you to 700 pounds, I can't promise you you're going to live a single day longer, right? So there's kind of a law of like, well, when is good enough enough? With VO2 max, we don't see that number. It's higher. That number cannot go up more where we don't still continue to see benefits. And so when we say things like be superior for the decade before, it's because of that. The data say, even if you're superior and you go from superior to more superior, that reduces your risk of all-cause mortality. It enhances survivability. Like it just, like all the studies, like they just continue to show that. And so we get greedy as hell here. We get whatever number you tell me, basically, I'm going to say go higher. which is like our clients and our athletes love it, right? Because like they know my answer. They'll share with me whatever. And I'm just like, great, not good enough. Like they just know the answer because I'm like, well, this is good, but there's only more benefit for getting higher. So I want to see numbers like that.
And if I could add in one more thing, something that you talk about is that, yes, we can go higher and higher and higher. And for some people that can feel intimidating, but if you truly do come in at the lowest end,
oh yeah,
just a modest improvement has a massive improvement in your life and longevity. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. If you go from the bottom 20th percentile to just the bottom 40th percentile. So what I'm saying here is going from the lowest possible score to the second lowest possible score, you generally are talking about a 2x hazard ratio. You've doubled your chance of surviving over the next 10 years. Just going from like the least fit person in the entire room to the second least fit category is the biggest magnitude of effect we see in VO2 max. The bottom category to the second bottom category is the biggest magnitude of benefit. And so what we will often say is like, can I just get you to the next ladder? If you want to then go from like superior to elite, it is helpful, but now you're talking about like 1.2 on that HR score, right? Great. The other ones going from least to second least is a 2X, right? It's 2.0s, it's 2.5s, it's stuff like that. So it is by far the biggest benefit we get there is just taking the people who are the least fit people in the entire room and getting them to the, you know, next 20th percentile or next 25th percentile or wherever we want to break up the data.
Well, Andy, I want to be respectful of your time, but I feel like if we don't at least touch on this for a moment, we'll be leaving people hanging a little bit. So you've gotten people excited about VO2 max and maybe doubling down on something that they feel like they've heard, but didn't understand all the weeds of it. We've talked about benchmarking it and the different ways to go about that process using smartwatches, laboratory, etc. Now, once you have a benchmark and you generally see where you're at, if we talk about exactly your statement there, which is getting you to the next rung, what are, I mean, you've done multiple hour episodes on this topic, but if we want to leave people with some sense of optimism that regardless of where they are, they can get to that next level, what are some core principles when it comes to that idea that you want to leave them with, you know, training, types of exercises, or just any kind of guidance that they might need to get to that next rung?
Yeah, sure. I actually really appreciate the fact that you want to bring this up and the way you phrased it, because all of this conversation, I hope, though I'm thinking back and I maybe didn't portray it this way, I hope this is a positive story. This is not a reminder of how you're failing and how unfit you are or how much you're disrespecting. That's not the story here. The story is, if you want to get better, if you want to increase your chance of living and living well, you have a huge opportunity to do so in something that is very controllable, like your VO2 max. And so while you can't necessarily always control your, certainly your genome, you can't control, and you can't always control your environment, and you can't always control your income and access to food and maybe obesity risk, like there are plenty of things that you can't control. This is one where I can say, hey, if you just go after this one first, if you only have the time or resources or energy or whatever else, and you can just do one thing for your health, don't smoke, don't drink, don't do anything like that, but go after this, right? Just make sure this one gets higher as much as you possibly can. So how do you do that? Well, if we go back to the very beginning, we talked about, well, what is VO2 max? It's your ability to bring in utilized oxygen. All you have to do is anything that challenges that, and it will improve. All right, now I can give you some specific examples, but please do recognize it. Those are just examples. They're we will say the methods are many, but the concepts are few. As long as you hit these concepts, the methods are infinite. So what are methods? You like to be on a bike. Great. You like to be in the pool. Great. You want to use walking only. You want to go to a gym. You want to go to a group activity class. You want to go to Pilates. Like, sure. All of it can work, right? You like kettlebells, you like dumbbells, you want to do it in your garage, you want to do it with weights only, you want to never touch weights. Great. The answer can be all of these things. You can absolutely improve your VO2 max with any of those. Those are the many different methods to get your heart rate up. Okay. Pick the ones you are most familiar with, the ones that you like the most, the ones you'll be the most consistent with. The research will show most successful weight loss, strength, and improvements of VO2 max, the number one predictor for all three of those outcomes is adherence to your program. So pick the one you will actually do and be the most consistent with. Okay. You want to do low intensity. You want to do walking. You want to do hiking. You want to do rucking. You want to go jogging. You want to go, you ride a bike. Fine. Great. What zone are you in? I do not care. Zone 1, 2, 3, 6. Don't care. Like all those things can work. A low intensity component. Awesome. As I mentioned, you want to do like my wife does. My wife is 42. We have two young kids. Her primary mode for cardiovascular exercise is she goes to a local spin class. She loves it. She loves it because she spends most of her day communicating with a 3- and 5-year-old. And sometimes she wants to be around adults. She wants to get out of the house, number one. She wants to be around other people, kind of. She's pretty introverted, but that like gives her there. And she doesn't want to she wants to check out a little bit, right? So you lead the workout program. You do the other stuff. So someone else is guiding her, running her and all that stuff. Okay, great. You couldn't pay me enough money to be in a spin class. Like I would rather be in my garage by myself. I'll do the exact same workout, but get me the heck away from these people. And I have the opposite. My job is to interact with the world. Her job is not. So she needs some interaction with people. I need time away from people. Okay, so we're doing that. Okay, great. Whatever fits for you. That's amazing. You wanna do high intensity intervals? Sure, that's great. You wanna do sprints? You wanna do assault bike? You wanna push a sled? You wanna do a CrossFit or F45 class? All of it is fine. You wanna do a combination? You wanna do 1 day a week low intensity? 1 day a week, some weights, 1 day a week, some intervals. That's awesome. So all of those things are possible. There are differences, of course, between the programs. I'm not indicating just go make up your workouts. What I'm trying to again tell you is you have the ability to really gear this thing to fit your lifestyle and income and everything else and injury paths and all that stuff. There are programs that can be made for all of you to meet you all where you're at. The core contexts are you've got to challenge your heart. You have to do it consistently. You have to be able to stick to your program over time and do that again over time. Then you have to be able to do the final thing here, which we call progressive overload, right? So you have to continue to train hard to challenge the system. And you continue to do that stuff and you give enough time, your VO2 max is definitely going to go up.
Mm, powerful. And just off of that note, you know, when you say train hard, the reminder that I've often heard you share is that it's hard for you. You know, they don't have to be hard for somebody else. It's hard for you. And that's progressive overload. It's tough for you. And that's how your body adapts over time. Last question on that, Andy, is then how long till somebody retests, right? So let's say they've been following a program. When should they retest to get another benchmark to see, are they heading in the right direction?
I would do a VO2 max minimum once a year.
Once a year.
Yeah, every 6 months is fine. But once a year for this client, because really what I want you to think about is, you actually asked earlier in the conversation about, should I start with the test done to get a benchmark? And that's really, really important. I want to be able to look back and say, okay, you're 50 years old and your VO2 max is 25. Okay. Well, I wonder, is the best it's ever been is 28? Or is the best it's ever been 60? Like, that tells me different information about what's happening to your health, right? If it's like, hey, this is the highest you've ever been, and we go to work out, it's probably going to shoot way up because it's never really been challenged. But if it's been there and it's coming down, it's like, oh man, 5 years ago, it was 50, and then it went to 40, and then it went to 30. Geez, something's going on. Like, you are rapidly declining. That is a different story than somebody who's just been there their entire life. So having something that you can look back, that your medical team can use, that your coaches or your trainers or whatever you're working with now, is really, really helpful. I want you to also think about what's happening in the future of human performance here. Maybe there's not much to do with these data now. What do you think is going to look like in 20 years, technology-wise, if we can look back and go, oh, look, you have 20 years of this testing. Mm. What can they do with that data? We don't even know. But data is going to be needed, right? And so the more information you have about your body and your physiology, and the same thing would be true for your testosterone, like stuff like that, right? Like, you don't know your testosterone is low if I don't know what it's been like the last 20 years. I don't know if it's low. Maybe it's normal. I don't know. So having serial tracked information about your health for critical variables is very, very important. That's why you do a physical every year, and that's why they keep records. Now you just need to add things like this, like your grip strength and your VO2 max and your body composition and some other stuff. Some extensive blood work, and that will give you a ton of information as the years go on. If you are 40 or 50, we're staring down the barrel of 50 to 60, 70 more years. So we got a lot more information to collect on you.
Andy, this has been fantastic. You know, so many people feel confused often by the decisions that they're making in life, and they're not sure, is this supplement working? Is this dietary change working? And obviously when experts like yourself come on and they provide an actual biomarker, something that people can look at to know that has a ton of data. Nothing has, as you've shared with us, more data than VO2 max. You providing this breakdown and explanation for our audience is literally adding years, decades, potentially, to people's lives who take action. So I want to acknowledge you and thank you for all your work in this space and for coming on today's podcast.
Oh, my pleasure, man.
I also want to mention, I'm a huge geek on your content. Loved your series with Andrew Huberman. And for our audience, they should stay tuned because I believe it's this summer your podcast is launching.
Yeah, actually, it'll be a little bit earlier than that.
Okay, amazing. Well, we'll have the link in the show notes below, as well as to all your social and the companies that you mentioned that you're a part of as well. Andy, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
I appreciate it, man. It's been great.
Hi, everyone. Drew here. Two quick things. Number one, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. If you haven't already subscribed, just hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcast app. And by the way, if you love this episode, it would mean the world to me. And it's the number one thing that you can do to support this podcast is share it with a friend. Share it with a friend who would benefit from listening. Number two, before I go, I just had to tell you about something that I've been working on that I'm super excited about. It's my weekly newsletter, and it's called Try This. Every Friday, yes, every Friday, 52 weeks a year, I send out an easy to digest protocol of simple steps that you or anyone you love can follow to optimize your own health. We cover everything from nutrition to mindset to metabolic health, sleep, community, longevity, and so much more. If you want to get on this email list, which is, by the way, free, and get my weekly step-by-step protocols for whole body health and optimization, click the link in the show notes that's called Try This, or just go to drewperowhit.com. That's DrewPuroHit.com and click on the tab that says Try This.